Primal Leadership by Daniel Goleman, Richard Boyatzis, and Annie McKee. Continued, Cassette 5, Side 2. When core values and norms are clear to people, a leader does not even need to be physically present for the team to run effectively. This is of special importance to the thousands of managers who work with virtual teams and whose team members are located all over the globe. In self-aware, self-managing teams, members themselves will step up to the plate to instill and reinforce resonant norms and to hold one another accountable for sticking to them. At one research laboratory, for example, no one can remember who started what has become a tradition during meetings of R&D groups. Whenever someone voices a creative idea, the person who speaks next must take the role of an angel's advocate, offering support. That way, the prospects are better for the survival of the fragile bud of an idea, insulating the innovative thought from the inevitable criticisms. The angel's advocate norm does two important things. It helps to protect new ideas, and it makes people feel good when they're creative. As a result, people are more creative, and resonance is continually reinforced in the team. So, team self-management is everyone's responsibility. It takes a strong, emotionally intelligent leader to hold the group to the practice of self-management, especially for teams not accustomed to proactively handling emotions and habits. When core values and the team's overall mission are clear, however, and when self-management norms are explicit and practiced over time, team effectiveness improves dramatically, as does the experience of team members themselves. Being on the team becomes rewarding in itself, and those positive emotions provide energy and motivation for accomplishing the team's goals. The empathic team. A team in a manufacturing plant knew that its success depended in part on getting the maintenance team to give their equipment top priority. So the manufacturing team members nominated that team for a Team of the Quarter award, and they wrote the letters that helped the maintenance team win. That relationship polishing helped the manufacturing team maintain its record as one of the plant's top producers. The effect was clear. By helping to trigger a feeling of team pride in the maintenance group, the manufacturing team created goodwill between those two parts of the organization and a desire to help the other succeed. The team used its skills to try to understand another part of the organization and how the two groups affected one another, thereby cultivating a mutually beneficial relationship. As a result, both teams succeeded better than either one would have on its own. An emotionally intelligent team, then, has the collective equivalent of empathy, the basis of all relationship skills. It identifies other key groups in the organization and beyond that contribute to the team's success, and it takes consistent action to foster a good working relationship with those groups. Being empathic at the team level doesn't just mean being nice, though. It means figuring out what the whole system really needs and going after it in a way that makes all those involved more successful and satisfied with the outcomes. The manufacturing team's proactive stance worked on two levels. It built resonance between the two groups, and it helped shine a spotlight on the good work of the maintenance team when it was recognized as the plant's top performer. Empathy across organizational boundaries, team to team, for example, is a powerful driver of organizational effectiveness and efficiency. Moreover, this kind of empathy goes far toward creating a healthy emotional climate organization-wide, as well as creating a positive emotional environment in teams themselves. Setting ground rules, the leader's job. More than anyone else, it is the team leader who has the power to establish norms, maximizing harmony and collaboration to ensure that the team benefits from the best talents of each member. A leader accomplishes that by moving the group toward a higher emotional tone, using positive images, optimistic interpretations, and resonance-building norms and leadership styles, particularly visionary, democratic, affiliative, and coaching styles. For example, leaders can model behavior through their own actions, or by positively reinforcing members who do something that builds the group's emotional capacity. One might do this by conducting a short check-in session before meetings start to ensure that people whose mood might be off can express their feelings and have them soothed. As Kenwin Smith of the University of Pennsylvania and David Berg of Yale University noted in their research, such emotions in a group are crucial signals to a leader that the issue or event at hand should be engaged rather than avoided, short-circuiting the trouble rather than letting it smolder. For example, a leader might make a point of phoning a member whose behavior has been rude and discussing the issue, or she might make sure she asks members who have been quiet what they think about a particular decision. Setting the right ground rules requires an emotionally intelligent leader. Again, common sense, but not common practice. The best leaders pay attention and act on their sense of what is going on in the group, and they needn't be obvious about it. Subtle messages, such as quietly reminding someone not to attack ideas during a brainstorming session, are powerful too. Under such leadership, teams over time naturally accumulate a common positive lore about how to operate with each other. Uncovering a team's emotional reality. The leader who wants to create an emotionally intelligent team can start by helping the team raise its collective self-awareness. As some of the examples discussed earlier illustrated, this is the true work of the leader, to monitor the emotional tone of the team and to help its members recognize any underlying dissonance. Only when a team can confront that emotional reality will it feel moved to change. By acknowledging a shared sentiment as simple as, "I don't like how it feels around here," a team makes a critical first step in the change process. A leader helps initiate that process by listening for what's really going on in the group. That means not only observing what team members are doing and saying, but also understanding what they are feeling. Then, once a leader has helped the team uncover its less productive norms, the group can come together around new ways of doing things. Strategies for exposing a group's emotional reality can take myriad forms. For example, a vice president at a financial services company told us, "I always start by looking not at how I see things, but at how my team members see things. I ask myself, what's happening with that person? Why is he doing those awful things? What is he afraid of or angry about? Or what is she excited about and what makes her feel secure and happy?" By modeling and encouraging in her team the key competency of self-awareness, that vice president made her division a center of excellence. Moreover, since its group norms included empathy and a focus on others rather than on its own wants and needs, the division was able to look beyond itself and identify leadership and management issues that the company as a whole needed to address. As a result, the division has hit several home runs in the programs and initiatives it has launched, including a management assessment center that's known in the industry as best in class. Another senior manager pays attention to the group as a whole. Aware that teams often behave differently at different points in their life cycle, this manager creates ways for members to talk about issues that are problematic in new teams. When convening a project team, she'll routinely get people to talk about their strengths and about what they can contribute to the effort. Subtly, this leader is making team members aware of two aspects of the team's emotional reality: inclusion dynamics, who's in and who's out, and people's roles, who does what and why. The openness she establishes with these team startups helps to create good norms, habits that will enable the team to deal with the inevitable conflicts later on. Another way that leaders can uncover the emotional reality of the group is by observing important signals. For example, during a recent merger between two European pharmaceutical giants, one manager checked an easy barometer of her division's collective emotions. She monitored the number of cars in the parking lot. When the merger was first announced, this manager noticed that the parking lot was always full and that many cars remained well into the evening. She knew that people were working extra hard because they were excited about the potential opportunities that the merger represented. Then, as the change process began to hit one delay after another, the manager noticed fewer and fewer cars in the parking lot. Clearly, many people's initial excitement and commitment was dwindling, and their anxiety increasing. But what about the cars that continued to appear in the parking lot day after day? Several pockets of people were apparently managing to remain productive and relatively happy, even during that sluggish process. At this division, it was discovered that while many of those people were motivated internally, either by a deep commitment to the work itself, such as the R&D scientists, or because they were otherwise skilled in emotional self-management, most people who weathered the change were protected from the turmoil by effective leaders. Those emotionally intelligent leaders made sure that they engaged their teams in the change process, giving them as much information and as much control over their destiny as possible. They noticed how their team members were feeling, acknowledged that those feelings were important, and gave people opportunities to express those emotions. For example, one R&D manager recognized early on that morale was tanking after a favorite leader left the company. Rather than ignoring the problem, after all, he couldn't change the situation, he talked to each of his team members individually about their sorrow and concerns. That kind of personal attention enabled him to then bring the team together so that it could refocus its energy on the more positive changes surrounding the merger. Another manager held team close-downs. Instead of simply shuffling people on to their next job as new positions were announced, on several occasions he brought the old team together to celebrate the past, mourn the end of an era, and discuss hopes for the future. These managers are good examples of leaders who managed their own feelings and the collective feelings in their units, so that people spent a minimal amount of emotional energy deciphering or fighting the changes. By keeping their eyes open and monitoring the tone of their groups, the leaders captured positive energy and found constructive outlets for negative feelings. Discovering the team's emotional intelligence. The CEO of a mid-sized company asked us to work with three members of an executive team who were not cooperating well together. The CEO thought the cure would be simply a matter of doing some team building to get things back on track. We decided to get more information. In our coaching conversations with team members, we looked for the emotional reality of the team and its norms, as well as themes concerning the leader's impact. We also took a snapshot of the team's emotional intelligence using the Emotional Competence Inventory, the ECI, and we assessed management style and the executive's impact on the climate of their organization. What we found surprised this CEO. True, the team wasn't working well together, but what it needed wasn't team building. The results of our interviews and the picture the 360-degree feedback painted about the team showed several underlying problems that required a very different kind of solution. Not surprisingly, there were a few problems with specific team members. One team member, for example, measured very low on self-awareness. He was completely missing the clues people gave him about his style of interaction. In meetings, he would express strong viewpoints and not understand how his aggressive manner was coming across to others. When people tried to get through to him about these issues, his body language said, "Lay off." Another team member, recently arrived from a plant halfway around the world, exhibited little understanding of organizational politics in the corporate center and was alienating teammates and subordinates alike with his countercultural behavior. What made it even more difficult for his co-workers and the man himself to understand was that, on the interpersonal level at least, he displayed excellent empathy and relationship-building skills. He just couldn't read the team's emotional reality, and he was always out of sync. Most of the time, these problems and other interpersonal issues become the focus of team building. When we looked deeper, however, we found that the real problem was a combination of ineffective norms and a negative emotional tone of the team. There was little self-awareness on the part of individuals or the team as a whole about their own group process. They did not manage individual team members' emotions or the group's moods very well, and they spent a lot of time and energy managing the team's negative emotions. In essence, it did not feel good to be part of the team, and people were avoiding working together. Part of the underlying problem was that the team had established some ineffective norms in response to the CEO's pace-setting leadership style. The CEO's high drive for achievement and his inability to show empathy were creating a dysfunctionally competitive environment within the team. Moreover, while this leader thought his vision and strategy were apparent to everyone, our data showed us that wasn't the case at all. The reason the team members were moving in different directions was because they were unsure of where the larger organization was supposed to be headed. Obviously, off-the-shelf team building would have done little to help this executive committee. By recognizing that its collective gap in emotional intelligence had created unproductive habits of interaction, the team could then see what it really needed to change. Equally important, the team recognized that in order for it to change as a group, each member also would have to commit to change as an individual. Armed with accurate information, we were able to target change processes for both the team and its individual members. This team snapshot illustrates the importance of getting a clear picture of the emotional reality of an environment before launching into a solution. Part of understanding the emotional reality is uncovering the particular habits ingrained in a team or organization that can drive behavior. Often, these habits make little sense to people, and yet they still act on them, seeing them as just the way we do things around here. Emotionally intelligent leaders look for signs that reveal whether such habits and the systems that support them work well. By exploring and exposing unhealthy group habits, leaders can build more effective norms. The previous example of the executive team unearthing its unproductive norms and unhealthy emotional reality points to a critical requirement for larger organizational change, something we will examine in detail in the next chapter. Getting people in the top executive team together to have an honest conversation about what is working and what is not is a first critical step to creating a more resonant team. Such conversations bring to life the reality of what an organization feels like and what people are actually doing in it. The problem is, these conversations are hot, and many leaders are afraid to start the dialogue, fearful of taking it to the primal dimension. Too often, unsure of their ability to handle the emotions that arise when people talk honestly about what is going on, leaders stick to the safe topics: alignment, coordination of team members' functional areas, and strategy implementation plans. While these safer conversations can set the stage for the next discussion about the team itself, the organization, and the people, most teams stop the discussion at the level of strategy and functional alignment. They find it too difficult to be honest with one another, to examine the emotional reality and norms of the team. And this causes dissonance on the team. After all, everyone can feel when the norms are dysfunctional and the emotional climate is unproductive. By not taking on the problem, the leader actually magnifies it. It takes courage to break through that barrier, and it takes an emotionally intelligent leader to guide a team through it. The benefits of such a process at the top are threefold. First, a new and healthy legitimacy develops around speaking the truth and honestly assessing both the behavioral and the emotional aspects of culture and leadership. Second, the very act of engaging in this process creates new habits. When people in the organization see their leaders searching for truth, daring to share a dream aloud, and engaging with one another in a healthy manner, they begin to emulate that behavior. And third, when truth-seeking comes from the top, others are more willing to take the risk too. As we have seen in this chapter, leaders cannot lead with resonance if their team's norms hold them captive. And they cannot change the team's norms unless they are willing to take on the leader's primal task, working with people's emotions and with the team's emotional reality. That truth is even more apparent at the organizational level when norms extend to entire corporate cultures. After all, even the most courageous individual finds it hard to buck an entire system. The next step for fostering new leadership, then, is to consider the real and the ideal state of the larger organization. Chapter 10, Reality and the Ideal Vision, Giving Life to the Organization's Future. For many years, Shoney's restaurant chain had a close-knit group of executives at the top, people who knew each other well, shared history and beliefs, and generally thought they had it figured out when it came to how to manage the business. The problem was that there was a lot of cronyism at the top, too. It was really an old boys' network of white, male, senior executives, and there was an underlying culture that promoted from the buddy system and left people of color by the wayside. All of that changed, however, in 1992, when the company was forced to pay $132 million to settle a class action lawsuit from 20,000 employees and rejected job applicants who claimed discrimination in hiring and promotion practices. Since that time, a cadre of new leaders at Shoney's has intentionally changed the company's culture, launching a decisive campaign to broaden opportunity for qualified people of color. In just 10 years, Shoney's has gone from an old boys club to one of Fortune magazine's top 50 companies for minorities. None of that change happened overnight, of course. The process began with an undeniable wake-up call, the lawsuit, regarding the reality of the company's dissonant culture. Then the new leaders entering the scene had to identify an ideal vision that would guide hiring decisions in the future. And finally, the organization as a whole had to embrace that vision, become emotionally attuned to it, before lasting change could occur. At Shoney's, leaders took on reality, and they led the organization into a very different future. They knew that, just as is true for teams, identifying the emotional reality and norms of an organization begins the process for change. Leaders can initiate a widespread shift toward emotional intelligence when they identify a company's emotional reality and habits, what people do together, and how. The real difference is that whereas the components of individual emotional intelligence competencies can translate directly to teams, organizations are more complex and thus the goal is broader, to foster emotionally intelligent leadership widely and deeply at every level, and to systematically create norms and a culture that support truth and transparency, integrity, empathy, and healthy relationships. That kind of transformation begins with leaders who are open to the truth, who can ferret out the emotional reality of the organization, and who can engage others in a compelling vision of their own future. When a company develops that kind of emotionally intelligent leadership at all levels, and when those leaders face up to reality, a transformed company can and often must emerge. When leaders don't listen. That first step, uncovering the truth and an organization's reality, is the leader's primal task. But too many leaders fail to invite the truth, which can leave them prey to the CEO disease, being a leader who is out of touch and out of tune. In their most benign form, such leaders seem to have no time for important conversations and to not build the kind of affiliative or coaching relationships that result in deep dialogue about what's working and what is not. They don't have enough real contact with people in their organizations to get a sense of what is happening, living in a kind of rarefied air that leaves them out of touch with the underlying emotional reality of day-to-day life. Less benign are leaders who use rigid commanding and pace-setting styles and who actually prevent people from telling them the truth. These leaders are clueless or in denial about the reality of their organizations. While they may believe that everything is fine, they have in fact created a culture in which no one dares to tell them anything that might provoke them, especially bad news. That kind of silence can come at a very high price. Consider the estimated 100,000 deaths each year in U.S. hospitals caused by routine medical errors, such as a doctor writing the wrong orders for a patient's medicine, or the wrong bottle being attached to an intravenous tube. Often these mistakes could have been prevented if only the command and control culture in most medical organizations had been acknowledged and changed. One physician who belongs to an Academy of Medicine task force addressing these issues told us, "In the culture of hospitals, a nurse who corrects a doctor, telling him he wrote too many zeros in an order for a patient's meds, can get her head bitten off. If medicine were to adopt the zero tolerance for mistakes that sets the norm for the airline mechanic industry, we'd cut medical errors drastically." Unquote. Of course, no one tells nurses they may risk the wrath of doctors if they challenge them. Those are the kinds of lessons about organizational culture that people learn implicitly by picking up on cues in the environment, and those cultures are not easy to change. Creating a hospital culture that supported zero tolerance would mean, for example, building in a far greater level of systematic checks and cross-checks than the medical field has thus far accepted. It would also mean challenging the widespread pay-setting and commanding leadership styles that hierarchical cultures encourage, and, as the physician put it, making it safe for that nurse to tell a doctor he's made a mistake. The toxic organization. When leaders operate with dissonant styles, the resulting culture is inevitably toxic. How does it feel to work in such an organization that lacks emotional intelligence? One manager we know described a leader and a toxic organization that ultimately left her physically ill and feeling as if she had lost her competence, confidence, and creativity. The cause was clear: a pace-setting leader who relied on threats and coercion to get things done. Despite the company having public service and education as its explicit mission, the president focused instead on short-term profit. The company had very little competition, so in this leader's mind, corners could be cut on quality with no risk of losing customers. Also troubling was that he openly expressed how little he cared about employees' welfare. "Bring 'em in and burn 'em out," he liked to say. Worse, he did not respect people. He was a bully. A typical example was the day a junior staff member mentioned to a few people, including the president, that it was her birthday and offered them a piece of cake. While everyone else smiled and said, "Happy birthday," the president said loudly to a nearby manager, "What's this bullshit? Can't you get your staff to work?" Then, turning to the junior staffer and looking her up and down, he said, "And you sure don't need the calories in that cake." That leader's negative style underpinned a set of highly destructive cultural norms. For example, as part of their jobs, staff members were expected to be duplicitous, making the customers feel as if they were elite and highly privileged, and that the very expensive services of the company were the best in the world. In reality, the customers were just regular folks, and the services hardly above average. The staff's forced smiles barely masked the tension they felt, and customers became more and more demanding as they began to realize that the services they received were mediocre. Moreover, the high-profile personalities who were often brought in for the conferences showed up only for cameo appearances, since they didn't enjoy working for the company either, frustrating both staff who needed them and customers who wanted them. Unable to reconcile reality with the fantasy that they were charged with maintaining, many of the staff found their day-to-day work meaningless and emotionally draining. The destructive habits in this company created a culture in which people stopped questioning how and why things were done and merely tried to muddle through day after day, driven by harmful attitudes, rules, and policies. And because the leaders in this toxic organization systematically discouraged attempts to improve the underlying culture, change was all but impossible. Today, this company's reputation has slipped considerably in the industry, and turnover is at an all-time high. Where change begins. This sad story doesn't mean toxic organizations cannot change. Quite the contrary. Change begins when emotionally intelligent leaders actively question the emotional reality and the cultural norms underlying the group's daily activities and behavior. To create resonance and results, the leader has to pay attention to the hidden dimensions, people's emotions, the undercurrents of the emotional reality in the organization, and the culture that holds it all together. In one large research hospital we worked with, this lesson was learned the hard way, but leadership did learn and successfully transformed the culture. The hospital reflected many of the ills experienced by U.S. healthcare in the late 1990s, increasing demands from patients for quality care and from insurance companies and government agencies for lower costs, demands in conflict with each other. As a result, local communities claimed that the hospital didn't serve them well, and the hospital was losing business to other healthcare systems. The leadership's answer was to craft a 5-year strategy to overhaul almost every aspect of how it led and managed the institution. They commissioned the design of complicated software to manage financial data. They outsourced functions that could be managed better elsewhere. They moved people around and out with an eye toward efficiency. But this hospital's leadership team forgot about the primary foundations for change, attention to the emotional reality and to the culture. They also failed to recognize how the staff felt about the change process itself. They imposed change from above, rational goals, clear mandates, and logical processes, but they ignored the force of the emotional realm. Within 2 years, the hospital was on the brink of spiraling downward, its vaunted new systems showing little return, and turnover having doubled. Our work with the hospital's leaders focused on helping them to recognize the dissonance in the organization and to recognize that the price of such discord could be a failed change effort. Gradually, the leaders began to find ways to let people discuss their feelings about what was and wasn't working through a process called dynamic inquiry. To their surprise, the leaders discovered that staff members didn't believe that the culture or the leaders themselves supported real change, risk-taking, or learning. For example, while people were being asked to do things in new ways, the small amount of training they received was considered old-fashioned and irrelevant. In fact, because training had been disdained historically in the organization, people felt discouraged from attending new programs and therefore could not learn new ways of doing things. Furthermore, staff believed that the change process was hindered by long-standing cultural habits. The confrontational way in which staff routinely treated one another, for instance, often amounted to rudeness and left people feeling beaten up and on the defensive. The atmosphere was rife with backbiting, vendettas, and petty warfare, discord that undermined any positive change program. By engaging people in a process of discovering the real, the hospital leadership took a step in the right direction. They acknowledged that people's feelings mattered and that the culture itself might need to change, and they provided a venue for people to talk about how to do that. Accordingly, momentum picked up and the tone became more positive. As the conversations continued and the management team committed itself to making critical changes, the staff began taking responsibility for its part in creating the new culture as well. Soon, people were feeling more positive about the change process. Resonance began to grow around the vision, and people responded with enthusiasm. There was a marked increase in attendance and participation at meetings to do with the new strategy, and the atmosphere at the hospital lightened dramatically. In other words, the culture and the emotional reality of this hospital began to improve, fostering positive energy rather than resistance, and resonance rather than dissonance. Today, it's an institution that has remade itself. Organizational systems are streamlined, turnover is down, and patient satisfaction is up, and the resonance-building norms that were established during the change process still foster commitment, high energy, and flexibility. Before the leadership's emotionally intelligent turnaround, the hospital was a good example of how an organization's underlying culture can kill even the best-laid plans. If the cultural norms don't support passionate action, innovation, or resonance, leaders will find themselves fighting an uphill battle. But perhaps the most unfortunate aspect of organizational dissonance is what it does to the individuals who work there. As their passion diminishes, they can lose touch with their own best qualities. In place of excellence and self-confidence, we've seen in such companies displays of false bravado, thoughtless compliance, or open resentment. People show up for work, in body at least, day after day, but they leave their hearts and souls elsewhere. How can an organization transform itself from a place that discourages people's best selves from making an appearance into a vibrant workplace where people feel energized and purposeful? That kind of change requires a great leap from a thorough understanding of the reality to a profound engagement with people's ideal visions of both themselves as individuals and as part of an organization. Sometimes, however, to create resonance, a leader first has to fight the organization's own underlying inertia. How do you do it, though? How does a leader uncover the emotional reality and sow seeds of the dream in a way that is motivating, not paralyzing? Discovering the organization's reality through dynamic inquiry. Many large companies have processes in place for systematically evaluating employee attitudes, values, and beliefs, a kind of proxy for the emotional reality. These processes can be very helpful, but the problem is that surveys measure only what they set out to measure, and they rarely tap the more subtle layer of subterranean feelings and complex norms that flow through an organization. This blind spot can result in simply measuring what people want to know, but not what they don't want known. And even when surveys do measure aspects of culture and leadership that are problematic, it takes focused effort and courage to address the issues. Too often, we see the results of such revelatory surveys just set aside. A process called dynamic inquiry was developed by Cecilia McMillan of the University of Massachusetts and Annie McKee as a potent way to offset the find-what-you-look-for effect of most surveys and to enable leaders to begin to address the underlying cultural issues that are getting in their way. This method of discovery uncovers an organization's emotional reality, what people care about, what is helping them, their groups, and the organization to succeed, and what's getting in the way. Through the process of discovering the truth about their organization, people begin to create a shared language about what's really going on, as well as what they'd like to see, their ideal vision of the company. Dynamic inquiry involves focused conversations and open-ended questions intended to get at people's feelings. While this may strike some leaders as a bit removed from the business issues, it is only when people talk about their feelings that they begin to uncover root causes of problems in the culture and the true sources of inspiration around them. Also, when people have authentic conversations about how they feel about their organization, there tends to be a very high level of agreement about what's working and what's not. As McMillan says, people begin to paint a picture of the soul of the organization, unquote. They create a language that captures the real truth about the forces that affect people's day-to-day lives in the organization, as well as their hopes for the future. From these initial conversations, usually held with both formal and informal leaders at all levels, and with people who have a point of view, themes become apparent that are typically much more meaningful and less generic than those that usually emerge from attitude surveys or more traditional interview processes. These themes, when taken to small groups, tend to spark spirited conversations about the reality of the organization. Perhaps more important, discussions about cultural issues, the emotional reality of an organization, and how it feels to work there, usually result in people feeling some ownership of the problems, the dream, and the process of getting from the real to the ideal. And by focusing not just on what's wrong with the organization, but also on what's right, people become aligned with a vision for change and see how their dreams and their personal contributions to the change process fit with the big picture. Once people are engaged in this kind of open dialogue about their culture and their dreams, it is very difficult to put the lid back on the box. Unlike surveys or one-time visioning sessions, dynamic inquiry starts a conversation that has momentum of its own. The creation of a shared language that is based on feelings as well as facts is a powerful driver of change. This shared language provides a sense of unity and resonance, and the resulting momentum helps people to move from talk to action. They feel inspired and empowered, willing to work together to address their collective concerns. This is exactly what happened at an Asian non-governmental organization, or NGO, when a leader we'll call Lang Chen took on a top role. Finding the Spirit at Work, Lang Chen and the Asian NGO. Imagine this. Your organization has 220 employees and you serve a customer base of 150 million people. Needless to say, an organization of those dimensions will have a hefty bureaucracy to support it. That was precisely the problem when Lang Chen took the reins at the Asian division of an international non-governmental organization. Although this NGO's mission of improving women's and children's health around the world was inspiring and very motivating for new employees, Lang Chen noticed that typically that initial enthusiasm became lost amid the day-to-day reality of the work. Passion and creativity seemed to fall by the wayside, and this leader sensed that the way people worked together and the systems that guided them were the culprits. The mission of the organization, in fact, seemed buried under its many regulations. Partly because of the weighty bureaucracy, the pace of work at the NGO was slow and quality mediocre, despite increased demands on the organization and increased criticism from funding agencies and governments. Nothing seemed to happen when it needed to. People displayed the dull complacency that comes with a job for life, a common problem in many large NGOs, and there seemed to be little connection between competence and success. There was only vague clarity about what it took to do well in one's job, and the organization had seemingly lost the capacity to evaluate itself. As long as the rules were followed, people's strengths and weaknesses went unaddressed. And in an organization dedicated in part to the needs of women, there were very few women in the office, and fewer still in responsible positions. Furthermore, there was a real division between the support staff and the people who actually provided the NGO services, with the direct service providers getting all the accolades for any successes. In both groups, people were comfortable with the status quo and reluctant to change, even when sometimes urgent circumstances demanded it. As a result of this environment, some of the NGO's core values, such as compassion and integrity, were clouded by misunderstanding and old policies. It was clear to Lang Chen that, overall, the staff felt disconnected, and the resonance that once had been a natural byproduct of the compelling mission was dwindling. Chen's challenge was every leader's, to find out what was working and what was not, and lead people to solutions. But how does a leader fight the inertia of a system? How does she develop an organization's capacity to assess and monitor itself and to function well in a complex environment? How, in short, does a leader perform the alchemy that transforms an organization? Lang Chen followed simple principles. She used an inclusive approach, employing dynamic inquiry and involving people in discovering the truth about themselves and the organization. She drew people together around their passion for the work and the dream of what could be. They saw her as a visionary, and they followed. She became a model for the changes she wanted to see. Finally, she put systems in place to support new habits and ways of doing things. This last set of actions, changing the systems, was critical in sustaining the changes. As Ruth Jacobs of the Hay Group notes, creating human resource practices that foster emotional intelligence, recruiting and performance management, for instance, is key to supporting resonance and a healthy emotional climate. Emotionally intelligent leaders know that their primal task is to look first to the organizational reality, identifying the issues with the full involvement of key individuals. They take the conversation to the organization as a whole, using engaging processes to get people viscerally involved in unearthing the current reality while tapping into individual and collective hopes for the future. This book is continued on Cassette 6, Side 1.